This is On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at what is happening in Western New York with news, features, and special guests. Now, here's your host, Penny Wolfgang.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to On Target, and thank you so much for joining us today. I'm your host, Penny Wolfgang, and we're here every week, and we talk about subjects that we think are interesting and topical and current and cultural. For all of us who live in the Western New York community, did I say educational? I hope I didn't leave that out. So we're very interested in everything to do with Western New York, and especially the history of Western New York. I think it's fascinating, the people that have influenced us and have changed our lives that we are sometimes not even familiar with or whose names we don't even know, but have had an impact upon our life here in Western New York in our history. And I think it's important to find out about it. So that is why we have, I think, the wonderful Buffalo History Museum here, which is in a private not-for-profit organization, which receives support as well it should from the County of Erie, from the city, from the Council on the Arts. And its mission is to kind of do what I just said at the top of the program, to let us all know about the history of Western New York, the history of, even though it's called Buffalo, it covers all of Western New York, how we got to be here, how we got to be what we are, where we are. And I really have been so interested in the museum for many years that I'm proud to say I'm a member of the board of, do they call it the board of directors, Tony?
Board of
Is
directors.
Is that what I am?
Yep.
Board of
directors.
Directors, I was right. And so I've been very involved with them for the last couple of years because their mission, as I said, caught my attention a while ago when I was trying to learn about actually somebody that was important here in Western New York that I had not heard of, and where do I go to find out about it? I go to the Buffalo History Museum. In the studio with us today is a know-it-all guy. Tony really knows everything. He's been so involved with the exhibitions and the planning of so many exhibits in the History Museum, and he even knows the history of the Buffalo Club, which is how we met, actually. He's been involved with showing all the people, portraits and history of the people that have had something to do with these institutions that we kind of take for granted here in Western New York, but that go back all the way in history for, I don't know, how many years? What are we talking about?
Buffalo Club's 1867. We're as old as Canada.
We're as old as the whole country of Canada.
The founding of Canada.
Yeah. So in the studio with us today on Target is Anthony Greco, and his real title is Director of Exhibits and Interpretive Planning. Seriously?
Yeah. I normally just say Director of Exhibits.
Yeah, I think we'll stick with that. For the Buffalo History Museum, I didn't ever know what your background, even though we've been known each other for quite a while, what your background was to be doing, interested in history and museums. Was it? Did you study history or did you study museum exhibits? Is there such a thing?
I don't know. There actually is. But originally, I started in law enforcement. I went to school at Fredonia for criminal justice, and I graduated in 2002, so it would have been right after 9/11, unfortunately, and a lot of government agencies were hiring, so I was hired by the Border Patrol. I went down, I took the civil service exam, they gave me four options of where to go, two places in Texas, two in Arizona. And I ultimately took the Nogales sector, the Tucson sector. But when I got down there, I realized it was just really wasn't what I was cut out for. So I was there for a short time, and I came back. And I had always been interested in history. My father one day, we were having breakfast, and he sat me down, and he was like, "Why don't you go to school for history? Go back to school for history, be a teacher, or work in a museum or something, because whenever you want to tell a story, you always want to make sure you tell people the background." And it really, a lot of my stories probably bored him to tears. But I think he was onto something because he inspired me to make that move. So I went back to Buffalo State for a history degree in undergrad. And serendipitously, the person who was the then acting director of the Buffalo History Museum at that point was also a professor at Buffalo State College, Cynthia Canitas. And I applied for, there was a job opening. Actually, at first I started off as a volunteer. Then I was giving tours as a docent. There was a part-time job opening. So I applied for that and got it. And then just kind of slowly worked my way up. And that was 13 years ago. And now here I am. And somewhere along the way, I realized that exhibits is probably where I was meant to be. I like telling the stories, kind of doing the research, telling the stories. And also I like actually getting hands-on and building them. I want to actually create something. And when visitors come in and they learn something or discover something or make a connection to a past generation, it's really rewarding. My favorite moment is when a grandparent comes in with a grandchild and you have kind of that intergenerational connection. It's really rewarding for all of us who work there.
Yeah, I have so much of that in Buffalo too, because a lot of people are generations. It's not the kind of city, luckily for us, where people just come and go or retire to, or transient. There's
right.
there's much more of stability for
there
generations
is.
In this area.
Yeah, you know what? I looked into that. I was trying to figure out exactly what the rate would be to figure out, you know, I think actually, to be specific, I think I was looking into why the Buffalo Bills have such a rabid fan base, and is it as fanatic as other cities or not? And I was trying to figure out that rate of how many people leave as opposed to how many people stay. And what you find is a lot of people do stick around. You've got a lot of families that have been here for, you know, four or five generations. But then also you find that the people who move away oftentimes come back. They'll go to get a job in the Carolinas or in Arizona somewhere, a burgeoning city, and then they end up coming back because they love this area so much.
And more importantly, no matter where they move to, they still root for the Buffalo Bills.
Absolutely.
No matter where in the country they live, right?
Bills backer bars all over this country.
Yes, as we've found out. And Buffalo groups, too. You know, we talk about that all the time. My daughter lived in Washington for quite a while, and there's, Buffalo this and Buffalo that, and they have Buffalo Night there, and, you know, everywhere in the country. People
yeah.
are just...
My father briefly had a house in Arizona, well, for about the past decade, mm-hmm. and he'd go out there, and it turns out, I think he probably had more friends out there than he did back home, because all the people he went to grade school with had moved away.
Let's talk a little bit, Tony, about the history of the our Buffalo Museum. The history of the Buffalo History Museum. People think, what is she talking about? But I mean it, because it's historical for many reasons. Also, the building itself is historical, so I want everyone to know what we're talking about.
So our organization was founded in 1862, and that's right around the time you find that a lot of organizations in Buffalo were also founded. And I think the reason for that is you had this first generation of Buffalonians, people who came here around the turn of the 19th century, people who came here. And, they came from the East, they settled down here, they improved the land, they built, growing businesses. But what happens is they got a little bit older and they realized that they needed to start preserving the things that, the artifacts, the documents and things that helped that our city is based on. So, for instance, one of the earliest stories I could dig up about the founding of the History Museum was there were two gentlemen, Lewis F. Allen, for whom Allen Street's named, Lewis Felly Allen, and Orsamus Marshall, who's another one of our founders. They were walking down the street and they met, and they were talking about some, as they called it, an Indian relic that they were looking for, they couldn't find, but they wanted to make sure it was saved and preserved because they felt it was important. We don't know what that was. We speculate that it was probably one of the arrowheads we have in our collection. But they got together and they said, you know, we should really form a society to preserve this history, to make sure that it's not lost to time. And that was really the first idea that was put forth in Buffalo to form the museum. That's 1862. Now, you had, at that point, former U.S. President Millard Fillmore was living back in Buffalo. And he was one of the founders of a lot of these organizations. He wasn't somebody who was necessarily on the at the ground level doing a lot of the work. There were other people to do that. But what he did that was important was he lent his name. His name had a lot of weight to it, being a former U.S. president. So he helped establish these organizations, and the fact that he was associated with them kind of made them a little bit more prominent, I feel. So we started collecting in 1862. We moved into the current building in 1901. Our building was the New York State Pavilion. It's the only building left over from the Pan American Exposition. And so we've been there since 1901. The building's 118 years old now. We're constantly doing work on it. We've got a couple large construction projects happening right now. And, you know, we've been in constant motion for 118 years, helping kind of share the stories of Western New York. We always say we share the stories of Western New York from the ordinary to the extraordinary. And I think that kind of gets to what you had mentioned at the beginning of the show, is that some of the people we talk about, some of the stories are well known, others aren't. A lot of times the stories that aren't well known are probably more important than the ones that are well known. So what we try and do in the exhibits is, you know, we like to hook people with things maybe they know and then teach them the rest.
And that kind of leads us to the exhibit which you're working on now and which is opening and which I think everybody is going to be very excited about, because it's called History Makers. Mm-hmm. And according to the press release that Cheyenne sent us, it features profiles, artifacts, and imagery of 20 of Western New York region's most historically significant and well-known figures. Oh, this is really going to be exciting, and we are going to talk in a moment about who these figures are. In case you just tuned in, you are listening to On Target with your host, Penny Wolfgang, and in the studio with us today is Anthony Greco, who's the director of exhibits for the Buffalo History Museum. We're just going to talk about the newest exhibition, which I know he's been really, really busy getting together and putting together and working on. And it's going to be available to all of us to see shortly, and we're going to talk about it, right?
Right. So History Makers, the idea came about because oftentimes museums will do these large thematic exhibits. For instance, we did one about, it was the centennial of U.S. involvement in World War I. That was our last exhibit, called Home for Home and Country. And what you get is a very in-depth story about one particular topic. And while those exhibits are great, I think oftentimes they can be a little bit, maybe a little bit intimidating if you're not familiar with the topic, or maybe you're just not interested in it. So what I wanted to do was create an exhibit that features a lot of different stories and maybe doesn't go into them, you know, in quite such depth. But it's a way for everybody to come away with, again, these extraordinary stories of Western New York history that perhaps they didn't know about. And inside, we've got lots of portraits, about 18 or so portraits, probably about 40 or 50 artifacts in total in the room. And some of them are just truly remarkable. There's certain ones, certain objects at the museum in our collection. By the way, our collection is about 100,000 objects, and that's just three-dimensional objects. In the library, we have about over a million different items between, you know, 200,000 photographs, 20,000 books, all the information that's been compiled over the years in Buffalo history. But some of the objects we tend to refer to just by one name. So when we talk about internally, when we talk about the gun, we're talking about the Ivor Johnson revolver that was used to assassinate President McKinley. When we talk about the coat, we talk about the coat that Vice President Theodore Roosevelt wore when he was inaugurated on September 14th, 1901 as president. One of the things we have in this exhibit is called the cake. It's a piece of Grover Cleveland's wedding cake. Of course, Grover Cleveland.
We've heard of saving wedding cake in the freezer, but this is going too far.
Yeah, it was 1886, so it's preserved quite well, and I've been told it's preserved.
Tasty.
I don't know. If you look at it, you might not say it's so tasty, but it was Grover Cleveland's the only president while in office to marry within the White House. And he marries a Buffalo gal, Frances Folsom, who's, I think, 28 years younger than he is at that point. And the piece of cake that we have is called the groom's cake. And I believe it was a tradition, a tradition at that point to save a piece of the cake and like sleep with it under your pillow and it'd be good luck, something along those lines. And one piece was preserved. I believe it's soaked in alcohol again, which is probably why it's preserved so well. And it's wrapped in foil and it's in this very decorative box. And we bring it out every now and then, but it's one of those things that you know, museums throw out the word artifact or object a lot, and it sounds very technical. But when you think about something like a piece of cake, a piece of food, something that's supposed to exist only for a short time, it's supposed to be consumed. To think about the fact that these things have lasted for 120 years, it's almost like we are unnaturally taking them from the environment that they're supposed to be in. You know, it's kind of this kind of abstract thought how I take it. But we've got bottles of wine in this exhibit that were from Millard Fillmore's Commodore Perry's trip to Japan to open the port of Japan. He brought back wine from the expedition, and it was bottled in Buffalo. And we've got these two bottles of Madeira wine that date to 1853. These things aren't supposed to be around still. They are supposed to be consumed. So I love the fact that these things have no natural right to be still in existence, but they are. And people, it's almost like they're time travelers, you know, that these things that people were looking at 100, 150 years ago, we still get to look at. It's an amazing thought to me, which is probably why I work in a museum.
Probably, but I think it's an amazing thought to everybody. But what's just as amazing is the Buffalo connection with some of the most, you know, of just what you're saying, history makers. Mm-hmm. Like you just, well, Millard Fillmore is somebody, I guess we always talk about that. And we always talk, I think we always talk about Theodore Roosevelt
and about McKinley and Roosevelt.
McKinley,
yeah.
I'm sorry, and about McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt. But there are the fact that you just told me that Grover Cleveland married a woman from Buffalo, mm-hmm. From here is something. It's probably one of those little known facts of the connections for us here in Western New York. That's sure. Astonishing.
Yeah, it's something that not a lot of people know. And you're right to say that we all know about Millard Fillmore. But if you walk down Edward Street, you can still walk past the home of Frances Folsom, who married Grover Cleveland. It's still there. It's got a little plaque in front of it. But until you're told about these things, a lot of people don't realize them, or unless you're naturally inclined to history and look it up, you know, on your own. But there are a lot of stories in this exhibit. We've got one of my favorite stories is somebody who I hadn't even heard of until I started researching who to put in this exhibit. And her name's Elizabeth Dickinson. And her name was passed along to me by Walt Mayer, our director of collections. And, you know, he said there's this, because again, with so many objects in our collection, one of our goals is to rotate as much as we can to make sure that people get to see the entire collection because so much of it is stored. So Elizabeth Dickinson, she's born in 1837 in Germany. She comes to Buffalo when she's 12 years old, and ultimately she ends up marrying Thomas Dickinson, who owns a small jewelry store. He wasn't much of a businessman. What he liked to do was tinker. So he would tinker with jewelry and watches. They end up getting married, and she becomes a partner in the business, and they grow T&E Dickinson Jewelry House, and it grows from this small store on Main Street. They move up Main Street a couple times, and it becomes one of the largest jewelry stores in the country. And, you know, from poring over newspaper accounts of her interviews with her along the way, because she was pretty well known in Buffalo history at the time, and then reading some obituaries that had been written about her, she was really the one. It was her business acumen that grew this business from next to nothing to this nationally leading jewelry store. And one of the interests, so we've got a portrait of her in the exhibit. And again, for this time in the 1870s, 1880s, I think she dies in about 1930. Incredibly unique for a woman to do that. And she has a quote, I'm paraphrasing here, but she says something like, you know, why would I stay in the kitchen washing pots and pans? I can pay somebody to do that. Why would I do that when I can be out making money? Which is a completely unique, ideology for a woman at that point. So,
a lady after my own heart.
Exactly. But she. So we had a portrait of her, which is in the exhibit, and we also had a small jewelry box, like the size of a ring box, but it was empty. So we were looking for something else to display. And the vast majority of our collection is accumulated through donation. We don't buy much, but at times we do. We have a small acquisition budget. And a collector that we know, a reputable collector, was looking to sell an item, a few presidential items. And the one that he had, one that we were interested in, was a check that was written out It was by Grover Cleveland for, I think, $74 or something like that in the 1870s. But the important thing is who it was written out to was Elizabeth Dickinson. So I don't know what he bought.
It might have, maybe it was a ring. I was going to say, maybe
Francis
it was
Folsom.
The wedding band.
But he definitely purchased something. But just the serendipity of the two things coming together like that, us bringing the portrait out, which hasn't been seen in such a long time, and then this collector saying, hey, I've got a check by Grover Cleveland, and then it's to Dickinson. What are the odds of that? So she's a fascinating story. And then another one is Mary Elizabeth Lord, who ends up she is the daughter of Ebenezer Johnson, who was Buffalo's first mayor. And she marries, she actually elopes at the age of 17 with John Chase Lord, who at that time was a young and promising lawyer. But he ends up being a religious leader and a very well-respected religious leader in Buffalo. But for being the wife of a very well-known Buffalonian and the daughter of our first mayor, she, as I say, carved a path entirely her own. What she did was she started the second SPCA in the country. So she was very concerned with animal rights and protecting animals, because this is at a time when you had animals still being used for labor. You had mules, and you had horses being used in a lot of labor. And even to the time of, you know, if you read stories about the Pan American Exposition and how they tried to electrocute an elephant, I can tell by the look on your face, maybe you didn't know that story.
No, I definitely didn't know that story.
Well,
on purpose?
On purpose, Jumbo the Second. But that's for a different day. But she was somebody who would make sure that the animals of Buffalo were cared for. She had her carriage was pulled around town by a team of Shetland ponies. And like I said, she started the second organization for the protection of animals. It was technically called the Buffalo Organization for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. The first such organization was started in New York City, but this is in 1867. And to this day, her legacy is still felt by the SPCA currently. They treat or care for about 12,000 animals per year. So her legacy is still very much with us. And it's fascinating because we have if you ever go in our research library, we've got a stained glass window of a woman with her dog, and that is Mary Elizabeth Lord. And we also have a bust of John Chase Lord, her husband, in the same room. And it's fascinating because the dog, everyone is curious about the dog, and her dog's name was Grandfather Smallweed, which is probably the most unusual dog's name I've ever heard. But she's one of these really amazing stories, again, that maybe if you're very well-versed in Buffalo history, you'd know it. But otherwise, you know, you come into an exhibit like History Makers, you don't even need to read the full label. Read the first couple paragraphs, and you'll come away with the elevator speech of why these people were important. And there's so many of them in this room in the History Makers exhibit. Joseph Ellicott, you remember Buffalo Bob Smith, the creator of Howdy Doody?
Absolutely.
A lot of people may not be familiar with the fact that he was from Buffalo. And it's funny, but when I was just finishing up the installation of the exhibit, you've got really amazing people in this room. We've got Dr. Roswell Park. A lot of people don't
realize. And people don't even know there was a real – I only learned this not that long ago, that there was a real person, Roswell Park, a doctor.
Yeah, absolutely. Roswell Park. And that's probably one of the most overheard things I hear.
Oh, really? I thought I was the only dumb one in the room.
Definitely.
Yeah, I know. It's so surprising. I don't know why.
But you see all these people. So Roswell Park, you see the presidents, Cleveland, Theodore Roosevelt. We have that coat I mentioned previously, the coat that Theodore Roosevelt was inaugurated in. That's currently on display, the Grover Cleveland items. But then, you know, so when I was installing the show, I like to watch visitors and listen to what they talk about, and the things they went right up to. We've got a display case with the Buffalo Bob Smith items. They're not original Howdy Doody marionettes or anything of that sort. But at that point, the show was so incredibly popular, they were mass producing these items. So we've got, you know, glasses and some marionettes and Flub-a-Dub, the different characters. Clarabelle the Clown.
The Clown.
So everybody goes up to the case, and that's That's that kind of intergenerational connection I was talking about, because grandfathers are people who are old enough to remember the show will come in and say to their grandchildren or children,
I used to watch this.
Yeah, exactly. This is what I used to watch.
When I was your age,
we'd wait, you know, the test pattern would be on the TV, and then you'd hear, you know, it's howdy doody time. And then another one that people are very, very fascinated by is Rick James. And from hearing people who have worked at Forest Lawn Cemetery, and they say that Rick James's gravesite is among the most visited at Forest Lawn. And he's somebody who, he's a little bit of a controversial figure. Of course, he had drug problems. He ran into problems with the law. You can't deny the fact that he was a tremendous musician, though. And so just digging up some stories about him, you know, everybody knows Super Freak and maybe some of his more popular songs, but I remember researching him and reading about how he had joined the Navy to avoid going to Vietnam. Then he went AWOL from the Navy, fled to Toronto. And when he was in Toronto, he ends up playing in a band. I believe they're called the Minor Birds. And he ends up playing with Neil Young and Bruce Palmer, who were in, is it Buffalo Springfield, Dusty Springfield? But I had no idea of that. So, you know, it doesn't matter how well you think you know Buffalo history. There's always something more to be discovered. But so Rick James is another very, very popular figure within the exhibit.
And the thing that's really important to is the diversity. I mean, you're talking about presidents, history, politicians, musicians, just the whole gamut of anybody that might have a civil rights activist, people that, you know, affected your life in some way in the history of us here in Western New York. So it's amazing. Let me just end by saying how, or telling how our listeners, they can see this, when they can see it, how they can see the exhibit, and how they can take advantage of these of the Buffalo History Museum right here in Western New York.
Yeah, so we have the History Makers exhibit. We'll be opening. We'll have a reception for members on September 17th, Tuesday, 5 to 8, and then it'll open. I mean, people can see it at any point after that. But on Friday, we've got M&T Third Friday, which is a free day at the museum. So everybody's welcome to come in, no admission. All the exhibits are available. And we ordinarily have activities for children that day, little pop-up educational activities. And we also have, in addition to History Makers, one we're just finishing up, is called Emblem of Equality, Woman Suffrage in Western New York. And it's a very timely exhibit that's opening up, again, on Tuesday. And it's in commemoration of the centennial history of the passage and ratification of the 19th Amendment.
We want to see you all there. If you're listening to On Target, I'm looking for you. So you better take advantage of this cultural institution that is such a gem here in Western New York. Thank you, Tony. And thanks for listening, everybody. Please join us again next week on Target. Have a good week, and goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to On Target with Penny Wolfgang, a program that takes an inside look at Western New York and our community. If you have any comments or suggestions, please write to Penny Wolfgang at 500 Corporate Parkway, Suite 200, Amherst, New York, 14226.